This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Dr. Kjersten Carlson to tell us about her book titled The Justice Laboratory, International Law in Africa, which is really interesting because it combines a lot of things that I think we hear about in the news, you know, international law, international criminal court. Ooh, there's lots of things happening in Africa. There's lots of wars there where my own research is. But actually kind of putting these things together and interrogating them properly and not assuming that sort of something based somewhere like The Hague or New York or Geneva is kind of where all the interesting innovation happens is a very useful intervention into the field. So this book does that and much more. So Kjersten, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
And thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Could you start us off, please, by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Oh, with pleasure. Thanks. Yeah. So I'm Kjersten Carlson. I'm a professor in Denmark, but I'm originally an American. So I'm sort of one of these transplants. And I now work at a liberal arts university, state-run university called Roskilde University, right outside of Copenhagen, and then teach in the summers at the American University of Paris. So this kind of, again, liberal arts institution. And in Denmark, there's a big division between how law is considered, law as a kind of professional degree, and then other forms of knowledge, so the social sciences. And I think drawing on my American liberal arts background, where I am also a lawyer, but I did a PhD in law and society, I really enjoy the challenge of trying to broaden the conversations we can have about law in what I think is a place that is less inclined to have those conversations. So in, I guess I would say my day job is working on creating a sociology of law, a law and society space for conversation, which in many ways leads to the book, which is why I wrote the book. At my last job, I was part of a research center, and we were trying to kind of get members of the research center, have the books get off the ground. And the idea was, and you'll laugh at this, what's something you could write quickly? Won't take but a moment. Something you know inside and out that, yes, and of course, yes. 5 years later, here's this book. I wrote it in my sleep. The elves were not very useful. But so the idea was that at that time I was teaching in a master's program that was combining sort of more your topic, which is this question of laws of war, law and international relations. And it seemed that there was a lot of specialized legal knowledge that people needed to have a piece of that felt really hard to grapple with and yet was in essential for them to be able to have interesting conversations and to move forward in the sort of research they wanted to do. So I thought, oh, well, I'm teaching these things and I've been doing a lot of research in Africa. Let me put together a book which is basically built around the question of what kind of opportunities does law or do courts offer when politics fail, right? So you're trying to make some political arrangement or there's some majority that's doing great, but you're part of a minority and you don't like it. So what tools does law offer and why should we in democratic societies be interested in what these anti-democratic institutions, courts, have to say for us? Like how should we see this question or these tools, these instruments as something that can further sometimes a parallel conversation, sometimes an intersecting conversation with the ways that we structure power, particularly in the field of international relations. So I set out to, you know, easily in just a few days, write up some of the things I knew. And it was, in many ways, this book was challenging because it felt like a lot of what I was writing about was stuff that I almost felt I had no business writing about. Am I an expert in this? I know something that regular people don't know, but then there are people who have great expertise who look at specific facets of this, and that's not where I want to go. So I was trying to write this generalist book for our undergraduate and graduate students. So for regular people, again, about the role of courts in international law, about the place of international law in international politics. So again, all of the things that were supposed to be easy as part of this research center, I changed jobs, I kept going with the book. And the book was also in some ways challenging to write because it had to go through peer review. So it was always designed for a general audience. It was always designed to hopefully have an interesting set of generalizable conversations about very specific courts, very specific circumstances. Again, from a point of view that maybe a specialist would say, yes, but a generalist wouldn't know that that exists. And I thought that managing the peer review process of that was also sort of difficult. Anyway, so that was the process of how I wrote the book.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I think it highlights a whole number of things about the content and the process that are intriguing and I think probably familiar to many of us in the audience. So with that as our kind of overview of the goal of the book, I'd like to kind of talk a bit about the decisions you made of actually putting this together, because with that kind of goal of making this more accessible to a general audience, I mean, there are so many directions that this could go in, right? There's so many examples you could draw on. So can you briefly tell us which case studies you examined in the book and how you chose these?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are five chapters in the book, which effectively are sort of five case studies. And the big driving force behind the book was sort of some beef I had with the International Criminal Court. And this was beef that arose, and my dissertation, my first books and articles were on international criminal law, and I'm a bit of a TWAIL scholar, I would say. So I've been looking at the former Yugoslavia and the law that had emerged from the ICTY tribunal. And so I turned to the ICC and then as a postdoc and felt like I was, again, coming in late. It was a time when the ICC was getting off the ground. All the cases were against Africa. Should we understand this as colonial? What role can criticism play? And then I was invited, a beautiful lark, a friend, a colleague at the American University of Paris, suggested to the State Department that I be a speaker in a presentation made to the African Union about the power and potential of international criminal law. And I thought, well, this is a strange thing for me to have to do. I'm very critical of this. And as I was presenting, I was getting the speech ready. There was a wonderful moment where the State Department spokesman looked at it and said, "Please begin your speech by noting that as an American with free speech rights, you do not represent the interests of the State Department." And I thought, okay, that's a good place to start. They're very confident. But in preparing what I wanted to say about the International Criminal Court for a kind of a group of representatives at the African Union, I realized that that court isn't just something one can be critical about. Like, I had been sitting there in my little ivory tower throwing my stones about the imperfection of how international criminal law is constructed. But in fact, the ICC actually is independent of the UN Security Council. That's not the way the US wanted it to be, but Canada and some other countries managed to sort of make a workaround. So you actually have an institution which has the potential to do something that doesn't exist in the world. So sure, it's flawed. Sure, it's problematic. There's an argument to be made about how it is an element of a colonizing series of power structures. All those things are true, but you might not get anything better. So I ended up giving this talk about the potential, how one could see the potential of this institution. And that really changed my take on the ICC, and I wanted to somehow reflect that. So the first chapter of the book is all about the International Criminal Court, and it looks at the International Criminal Court as this flawed but promising institution, and wants to sort of illuminate, use what it is that I know about international criminal law, the kind of the conceptual flaws about making a law which isn't guided or girded by any kind of political constraint. So that law ends up being problematic, while at the same time having a lot of potential. So that was the, in a sense, that was the impetus for the book. So when I would sometimes despair, as you know, as it wasn't written in the first 30 days or whatever it was that it was supposed to do, I thought, no, this is an interesting story about how it is that the ICC was created and how the interests of certain African leaders aligned with the institutional interests of the court to have work, to create a caseload that ended up making international criminal law, making precedent, having cases, but not really doing the justice work that had been the hope of, I think, many people who were behind the ICC when it started. So that that's kind of the longest chapter in the book. And I wanted to, there, one of the things I always tell my students is international law and international criminal law also, it's written in English, it's all free online. So it's a good place to dig in and do research and look at things. It's not hard to get the materials. So since this is one of my kind of hobby horses that we cannot leave law to the lawyers, we need to get in there and read it ourselves, I spend some time in that chapter going through those cases. What should we see? What's at play here? And what are the concepts and the ideas that emerge from the jurisprudence that's produced by the court? And then the other four chapters were to a certain degree, and this was also as the book went through peer review, you know, one of the questions was, how did you choose these examples? And that's always this tricky thing, like, is there actually a rationale for how I chose the examples? It's clearly not good enough to say, I found it interesting, or I was there already. But in fact, I had done a bunch of work on this hybrid tribunal that was set up in Senegal. So one of the chapters addresses that. It's a little known tribunal. It's really interesting. It arguably did something that everyone said was impossible. It put a former dictator, the head of Chad, Issa Nambré, it put him on trial. It convicted him. It did it for $10 million. Nobody died in the process, which is to say no witnesses were killed. There was no terrible corruption along the way. So everything worked. The problem with that tribunal was that it only got Abré. So you could say, and I do say, the argument I make in that chapter is that, so you have this interesting institutional setup with all sorts of things to celebrate, but then ultimately you can't take on the question of what does corrupted power in Chad look like? What kind of responsibilities do you insist on for the state? In fact, you get this one ex-dictator who arguably is by this time living as a private citizen. In the most cynical reading, like, he's used up all the money that he had, so not even Senegal wants to protect him anymore. That's a very cynical reading, but it's not non-available. I wanted to look at Rwanda because there's so much amazing area scholarship written about Rwanda and the failure of international criminal justice to bequeath all the things that were hoped for it, that were written about what it could do in Rwanda. But I feel like it doesn't often get out of that sphere of area studies, African studies, or even Rwanda area studies. So my Rwanda chapter is really, it's in a sense, it's a literature review of, if you were going to read a bunch of very smart people about Rwanda, you would learn this. And that was also a fun chapter to write in many ways. At some level, it really begs the question, what business do I have to be doing this? But it, I presented it at conferences, and it really got lots of reactions. It made some people mad. So it was interesting to see what happened with that chapter. And then also, as the book was going through review, many of the reviewers were actually really delighted by that chapter. Like, it makes sense of something that we didn't know. And there, it's a discussion of, we know about one Rwanda genocide. There's arguably a second Rwanda genocide, if not a genocide, certainly a mass killing that's effectuated by Kagame under his leadership over a long period of time. And that story doesn't get told and is actually so politically contentious that people die for trying to tell it. And so that seemed like an essential and important thing to try and make available to people, that, again, is it's normalized in area scholarship. There's no question but that this is what's happening, but it's not what you can find in the mainstream. Then the South Sudan chapter was looking at, in a sense, it was trying to test this model for development and transitional justice. And they're looking at the idea of setting up a court that's been promised, but absolutely no one intends to set up. So what's going on there? And that gave me a chance to go and talk to diplomats, a lot of diplomats in at the African Union and people who are working in development in across Africa in various places. So that it was sort of nice to have the chance to talk to people on the ground to sort of ask the question, if no one thinks this will happen, then why are we working towards it? And then finally, I felt like there was, I had not intended to write a book. I really did not want the book at all to suggest that we should despair about the state of law in Africa. Instead, I wanted to show the complexity and interest and creativity. Even when you're dissatisfied, we can be dissatisfied with what the ICC is doing in Africa, but we have to respect the ways in which African politicians and groups have managed to see what makes that institution tick and use it to their own advantage. You know, it's politically very sophisticated. So I wanted to tell the story of political sophistication. I wanted to make clear things that are, again, I think not generally known to a mainstream audience, but I didn't want everything to only be kind of doom and gloom. So it's always this, I always laugh because I would describe myself as a progressive human rights oriented person on the left. And yet I always find myself railing against these institutions that are developed by my friends, right? So what does one do in this situation? And the East African Court of Justice was doing some pretty creative, interesting human rights work, even though it's a trade court. So the final chapter, and this I had found out about because there was a PhD at the place where I was a postdoc who was writing on this. So he had made me aware of that court. Then I had gone and done some interviews. And that just seemed like such an interesting case study. So it, in some ways, begs the very questions that animate the whole book, which is, okay, we want law to work in parallel with, but as a counterweight to political influence. So when we have a trade court that makes human rights decisions that we who like human rights are happy with, we celebrate it. But otherwise we might say, oh, this activist crazy court is working outside of its jurisdiction and its competence. So, and we don't have an answer for that. So that I wanted to tell the story of what the court's doing, because from a human rights perspective, it's a hopeful story, but it still brings us back to the larger question that drives the book, which is, what's the role of law in terms of how we make an alternative narrative to politics, and where should the limitations run?
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
I have already planned what I'm going to ask you next, but I'm really glad I did, because if I hadn't, I would have been like, wait, those are so many interesting threads to pull on. How do I possibly choose where to start? So thank you very much for that explanation of what the book is doing and why. I think that's an incredibly helpful foundation. And I am going to now ask you about them in more detail, pretty much going in the order of the chapters. Seems like a vaguely logical organizational structure. But the reason it's tricky is because like that actually goes back to that big point you just ended with. So, you know, they all the things go together. Can you start us off then thinking about sort of this combination of politics and law, and especially the narratives we tell about, are they in opposition to each other? What kinds of politics do we like? Who gets to make those kinds of decisions? One of the sort of big narratives around international law in Africa is around kind of the ICC and who it goes after and who it doesn't, and whose voices it privileges and whose it doesn't. And there's obviously, I mean, a whole lot of research into the nuances of this that show that there are some genuine critiques to be made and also some political points to be scored. So can you help us understand to what extent is it accurate to say that the ICC has faced challenges in Africa because of things the ICC has done blunders, tone deaf moves. Is that kind of the source of challenges for the court in Africa? Can you help us complicate the picture?
Oh, sure. Thank you for asking me to complicate, because I was going to say, it's such a great question. I'm only going to like muddle it with my various complicated ideas. But I want to say it's, in a sense, it's kind of nothing so simple as all that. I think that you can say that the ICC is tone deaf and it's made errors, like, sure. But I think it's kind of interesting to start on the other side and ask, well, what does the ICC say about itself, right? How does the ICC understand its work in Africa? And in this way, the ICC is like a lot of international criminal law institutions. It starts with this idea of law and politics are separate. Law is pure. It's objective. When we talk about core crimes, we're talking about the kind of atrocity crimes that have no justification, right? There's no, you can't say, well, I commit this genocide so that I, you know, end my war quicker. Nothing permits you, no practicality allows you to engage in genocide. No practicality allows you to engage in torture. You want to argue that running your state works better when you torture people, that's going to be a losing argument under these concepts of international criminal law. So international criminal law proponents start there. And so they say, asking who the ICC tries is the wrong question, because it's important to notice what kinds of activities are impermissible, can never have any justification, and then to make sure that the individuals who are perpetrating them are punished. And that's how we make a better world. And I probably overquote this, but this is the plaque that hangs inside the ICC, towards a more just world. Like, these guys, they're serious. They put it on a plaque. You walk by it when you walk in. So this idea that there's a utopia, and that utopia is somehow encompassed in the principles and precepts of international criminal law, drives this practice. So if you start there, then the political problems of, gosh, you seem to only try rebel leaders, don't you feel bad about that, is it's kind of a non-starter, because we're not supposed to ask, in this pure land of law outside of politics, which, by the way, is the only way that law stays non-corrupted, we're not supposed to ask, who are these people, right? So I think in that way, we have a conversation that's actually, we have two sides that are talking past each other, right? So when one side says, it seems to us that you never seem to go after the sovereigns and you always take the rebels, and then you have the international criminal law proponents who say, we're building a better world by asserting that certain behaviors are never justifiable, and we take who we get and we build that world. And so we don't ask who these people are. Do you see what I mean? So I think that this talking past is a central part of this story. And there's no way to, what do you say, like, square that circle? Like, you can't come around. You can't make those ends meet. Mm.
I think that's a very useful intervention into how we think about these narratives and kind of how, not just, we should interrogate them, but here's a way to interrogate them, which is a very helpful intervention. But I'm going to make sure that I don't keep asking you about the one point and move on to another piece of the book. Otherwise, I'm going to spend all this time just asking you about one piece, and there's so many others. So let's talk about the ICTR. Let's talk about Rwanda, because, as you said, it is normalized within area studies about kind of what happened after the genocide, what has been done by Kagame's regime. But that isn't necessarily connected even to specialist histories about the ICTR itself, right? Much less kind of in a broader conversation. So can you connect them for us? How did the ICTR come to be not just kind of happening in the same country as a consolidation of a very specific kind of power, but in fact, the ICTR is part of that method of consolidation? How?
Yeah. Yeah. And so this, I think, would be part of that that story that I want to tell about sophisticated political manipulations on the part of African politicians. And I guess this, I hope, is an addition to the narratives we have about how Africa runs. I think I have at some point in time in the book, I talk about, you know, what is a Western perspective on Africa? Because if you look at these international institutions, that is challenged, right? There is a sophisticated, good manipulation by those in power of these international institutions, which exist because they're supposed to be somehow objective and not subjected to local interests, local power actors, but they absolutely get captured by local power actors and put to their own use. And so Kagame's Rwanda is this example. And you see this with the ICTR, where there's only one kind of case that can be prosecuted. And it's a case, I apologize, I cannot make my email turn off. It's a case against the Tutsi genocide that doesn't include any kind of other victims. That's just not part of the narrative. And partly it's much easier. It's a complicated series of groups. It's names that Westerners are unfamiliar with. It's a history that Westerners don't know. Kagame, who himself grows up in Uganda, right? It's complex. So simplifying the narrative makes it, in a sense, easier. And the ICTR is absolutely, it's captured and it's utilized to do that. And ultimately, again, this goes back to the jurists, the international criminal law, people working in international criminal law. There's a perspective on that that says, as long as we're actually insisting that we're finding atrocity crimes, we're prosecuting atrocity crimes, we're doing good, like we are making the world a better place, we don't need to ask against whom, because that's not part of, that would be political and that would not be legal. And then you need materials to prosecute those. So Kagame's in charge and he's providing the materials. And courts don't have, they don't really have many police officers. They don't have, these international courts really have a problem of enforcement. So they require cooperation. So you can, and you might ask for something, but you get something else and then you prosecute that thing. So this is, again, this is part of the story that I want to tell of the way in which all of the interests converge. The institution, like the ICTR, like the ICTY, like the ICC, those institutions only work when they're working. They need cases. They need people who are defendants. They need to bring cases against them. They need material proof against those people. Without those things, it's just a bunch of people sitting around collecting paychecks, waiting for something to happen. And it's an institution that's not making jurisprudence, that's not advancing what it is that we think about atrocity crimes. So everyone loses when there's inactivity and everyone wins when there's activity. And of course, this everyone is a very cynical everyone, because in the case of Rwanda, it's the power brokers who have a story about who are the victims and who are the perpetrators. And then they use the institution, they instrumentalize the institution, because the institution wins when it has work. And the institution can say, well, we'll get to these others tomorrow. But what happened in the case of the ICTR is it was shut down and shut out before that ever happened. By then, Kagame had consolidated power, and that has not taken place. So then you have the consolidation of an authoritarian regime where it's actually illegal to put forward other forms, other narratives. So did I answer the question?
You did, absolutely. Good. And I guess you helped answer part of the next question, which is the fact of it closing when it did, is the fact of kind of needing someone in power to help facilitate, as you said, the necessary bits of making the court work and not just sit around. Is that why, or part of why, you think Kagame continues to enjoy the support of Western states?
Oh, that's interesting. It's so interesting to me. I do not know why Kagame enjoys the support of Western states. And we just cannot underscore that support enough, because not only is Rwanda successful in our scare quotes, but run on Western money, on Western donations, but we now also in Denmark, where I work, in the UK, we're talking about sending refugees, and actually, you know, recognized refugees to Rwanda. There are deals being made with Rwanda as a sort of safe third country where refugees who are recognized by European countries might be sent. And how this has come about, I think, is is interesting, and I don't know the answer to that. The area scholars, the people who know more than I do, they often point to like how clean and modern Kigali is, you know. So authoritarians are good at like keeping the streets clean, and if you're in Kigali, everything seems to work, and you can get like a cafe latte, and you can like get on the Wi-Fi, and so everything feels super modern, and people don't go outside of the capital, so they don't see how things are outside. That's what the area scholars say. That explains what this is. But again, it seems to me that Kagame has done a very good job understanding where the levers are that he can move, and has done that well. So his is a story of effective political manipulation. But the reason why we want to tell this story is we go back to what's the purpose of international law. If international law stands separate from politics, it loses so much. So it's not local. So it's expensive. It's often clueless. It doesn't understand local subtleties. You need translation. So there's so many things that are lost and cannot be reclaimed by trying to make something legible to internationals when you bring them in. So if you're going to do all those hard things, then what do you get in return? And the promise is that we have a shared understanding about what rule of law statecraft looks like. What does a Rechtsstaat, what is the state of rights, a rule of law state, what is it? And this is where we've been really disappointed in the work of the ICTR. And this is where Kagame has quite simply, he has outfoxed those who work with him.
But this isn't the only place that exactly those conflicts and tensions are between kind of the idea of what is a well-run court and what is international law for. It's meant to do these things with the quote over the door. But then, hang on, there's on-the-ground politics that are very real and don't necessarily nicely fit into that. You've just described it in the context of Rwanda, but the Chad chapter in the book tells a very, in many ways, quite similar story. So I'm wondering if you can tell us what happened in this case when we see kind of those two things clashing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also, of course, this is the story I feel is essential to tell. So when we find all these parallels, you know, I guess I am inviting all the other scholars out there to write back and be like, you've completely misunderstood this. This is the fun part about having these conversations. But yeah, that Chad, in the sense, is something very similar. There we have an institution which is successful because it runs. And when I use the example, people don't die, like the ICC, unfortunately, has been plagued by dead witnesses. I mean, people who cooperate with the ICC, bad things end up happening. And again, it's because you have some investigators from The Hague who show up in, you know, northern Uganda. Ooh, I wonder who those guys are. They might be here investigating war crimes from The Hague. Oh, did I see so-and-so talk to them? Like, they're not very subtle. And even who The Hague employs, the ICC, when you talk to some of the people who do that work, they come from police investigations domestically. And I wonder, does that translate? Like, does that work the same? So you just have sort of many problematic cases at the ICC where you cannot accept witness statements, where the proof that's been gathered by the ICC is really problematic. And this is one of the things that the investigators in the hybrid tribunal that operated in Senegal, the Chambre Extraordinaire Africaine, the Extraordinary African Chamber, which was set up to try Issa Nabray and others responsible for atrocities in Abré's regime. It ended up only getting Abré. But one of the things that I found when I was doing interviews, and I went back and forth to Senegal for 4 years, and I wrote another book with two other people, edited a book where we sort of went through we use these first-person accounts, which I'm very proud of as kind of an empirical survey. It's called The President on Trial. So if you wanted to kind of dig in and look at what the people on the ground say, I reference that book. So based on what I had learned in that process, one of the things that was interesting in relation to the ICC had to do with how investigators said, you know, we're not that different. Like, we go into Chad, we get it. We have the same, we have a French system. It works the same way. We're used to asking similar questions. We can talk to their magistrates and we understand each other. So when we have their magistrates doing interviews, we know the kind of things that they ask. We know how to manage that information So the translation costs in that sense, and here I don't mean just linguistic, but I mean sort of structural, institutional, were lower. But again, so you had this court that institutionally in those ways, it was cheap and it was safe. And in all those ways, it worked. And that's really something that should be celebrated because it doesn't have to be that way. We don't have to look very far to see that it doesn't have to be that way. But the larger question of, okay, if there's a rule of law concept structure that insists that when you commit atrocities, when you're responsible for atrocities, they've happened on your watch, then you're going to be held criminally liable. That rule of law idea can't only be applied to people who are no longer in power. That should be applied universally. The idea behind the rule of law is that no one has immunity from it, right? These atrocity crimes, because they cannot be in any way permitted or excused, then there just can't be immunity. And here, what happened in the Abreu case was, as the investigations went up the chain and started asking the then president of Chad, who was Déby, who had replaced Abreu, had beaten him and replaced him, hey, it seems like a lot of the crimes that Abreu is accused of continued in Chad under your regime. Maybe we should look at those. Then those investigations were shut down. So once again, we have to decide, what's the takeaway here? What's the celebration? So there's an institutional celebration, a court that worked without endangering people who cooperated with it. That's good. But in terms of the rule of law, what's our takeaway? And there again, you can see that this is my message. It's the reason to do this was to insist that there's one rule that all are subject to. And that's not what you get with this court.
Yeah, definitely a tricky precedent to have, and a tricky precedent to go, yay, celebration. It's like, okay, that raises some questions. All right, I want to move away a little bit from kind of the similarities we've been talking about so far between Rwanda and Chad, and ask you about one of your other cases, South Sudan, which I think has a great example of something that, no matter how much you do or don't know about international law, would raise eyebrows at if made more known to the general public. So that in and of itself is, I think, a useful contribution. The fact that I'm referring to is that both parties of the many years long now South Sudanese conflict keep pressing for a tribunal. They keep asking for one, even though, maybe especially because, it doesn't seem particularly likely to happen. Why are they asking for it? And what does the fact that they keep asking for it tell us about this bigger question that you're asking of what is international law for?
Yeah, thanks. And again, like, here is where I'm, you know, in some ways out of my league. I don't know. So all I can do is sort of theorize as I try and sort of take us in the chapter and tell us some of the things I can say, right? I can say, how this comes about, who's asking, what it looks like, how it changes, what's the situation, as we know it at the time of that writing, in terms of governance in South Sudan. But my best guess would be that this is part of the rhetorical narrative of who's playing in a legal way, right? So there's something very convincing. And again, if we go back to Rwanda and we look at Kagame, right, like, one of the reasons that Kagame is able to play with Western countries is part of these negotiations, can be considered as a safe third party state, is a notion that somehow Rwanda has been transformed to a rule of law state. Like, that's what international justice did there. And so obviously, if you look too closely, I think that doesn't bear out, but that's the narrative. So that states want a piece of this reputational power, which is the power of using law as opposed to other forms of blunt political interest. And then I think because there's blunt political interest, probably both sides are not too concerned about their capacity to bluntly politically influence whatever might happen if the court were actually to occur. Sort of like we see with the Abreu tribunal, right? Where Chad was the major donor to that tribunal and could could insist, you know, Chad believes in the rule of law and human rights, and this human rights offender, Chad wants to bring them to justice. And so that is why Chad is supporting this tribunal. Oh, except we're not against Chad's current leader. Absolutely not, or leader at the time, since deceased. So I think that it's part of that reputational argument. So you get to try and gain from being the pro law, pro rule of law, pro international standards, you know, what used to be called in the most delightful colonizing way, you know, the standards of civilized nations, right? We enter this, it's no longer acceptable language, but that's the club that we're entering. And we're not very concerned about what it'll be like to be in that club, because we know that we can influence things in whatever way we need to.
Definitely some interesting assumptions and legacies playing out here. Maybe not where people would expect. So I found that a very useful addition to this book. Speaking of useful additions, this chapter I want to ask you about next is perhaps the one that I knew least about going in and almost felt bad about that. I'm like, oh, but this is the kind of optimistic one, and that's the one I don't know about? Goodness. So you mentioned it a little bit earlier, the East African Trade Court. Can you tell us more about why it might be the more optimistic, the more promising laboratory, even though we might not expect a trade court to be the one taking on human rights cases in Africa?
Yeah. So this kind of goes, like I said, and again, I kind of want to, I feel the gaze of the critical upon me, like as a caveat, right? Like, you know, we who are like pro-human rights, we're like, a human rights court, it's so good. But it still begs these questions of, well, what happens when that human rights court starts to find rights that I don't think are so rightsy? You know, like, am I going to be just as happy with that court suddenly deciding that it has, I don't even know what it could decide it has jurisdiction over, and then starts ruling against rights? However, that said, one of the challenges for courts to act outside of, like in parallel to, as alternate sources of power in Africa, has to do with whether or not countries accede to the jurisdiction of those courts. So you have this African Court of Human and People's Rights, a really interesting institution, taking really interesting cases, working, again, a young institution doing interesting things. However, the value of a human rights court is that it allows citizens to bring cases against their states. Hey, state, you know, the social contract says that you, this government, is legitimated by its relationship to me, and that relationship has been sullied by these series of acts, and I did not get redress in the state. I take it supranationally so that some objective third-party judge can take a look at this. But in order for that to be possible, states have to permit their citizens to go to these courts. And one of the things you see with the African Court of Human and People's Rights is many states are simply not signing on. They're members of the court, but they don't allow their citizens to bring cases. So there you see states trying to, I think, again, my guess at this is, take some of the reputational gains. I support a human rights court. We are a rule of law state. Look, we support human rights, but it's really pesky when citizens start making complaints about the policies enacted against them. We don't want to have to deal with that. And so the East African Court of Justice, by determining that it did have jurisdiction over human rights cases, because you cannot engage in trade without human rights. And here it's in kind of good company, right? The European Union has something not entirely dissimilar, right? There's no trade between democracy without rights. By making this broad interpretation, giving itself a jurisdiction, it managed to capitalize on the fact that lots of countries actually want trade matters to be settled supranationally. So trade is something that countries can see the value in citizens being able to be involved. There's a kind of direct economic benefit that can come to countries, and then the court expands that, builds on the back of that to allow other kinds of cases. So again, it's a clever, creative expansion. And as I go through in the chapter, you can read how the court does it. It's not insane. It is creative, right? So, and I think it's always lovely to see how courts construct possibilities for themselves.
No, it's absolutely fascinating to see it. So I'm so glad that this got added. And in fact, I'd like to almost ask you to kind of expand on it as a penultimate question of, in terms of watching this construction, seeing what develops from it, what are some courts or cases that you think we should maybe keep an eye on to see how this combination of international law and politics continues to evolve in Africa?
Okay. Well, so again, I think the African Court of Human and People's Rights, it's a really interesting institution. More and more research is coming out. When I went to Tanzania a few years ago, I mean, the judges in that court and the clerks in that court were super generous. It was basically open, and I just kind of sat around and people talked to me, and it was just really fascinating to sort of the ethnography of seeing how people work and how cases happen. So that case, I think that court will get busier, and I think there's, especially for like young international law researchers, people who want to spend some time on the ground, I think that's a fantastic court. I write very briefly in the conclusion about the Malabo Protocol. The Pan-African Lawyers Union, which is also situated in Arusha, or I think it's got its headquarters in Arusha, it's been working really diligently at trying to expand a notion of what international law would cover. And there they started with this concept of, well, what do treaties cover? Because if we have a treaty, then there must be international interest. And so then if we have a court, an international court, then we would want that court to deal with potentially any topic on which we have a treaty. So there's been an expansion to consider the questions of like of corruption or environmental damage. Like, could an international court, an African court, take on those topics as well? And I think I think that's super interesting. And I also, but I really appreciate the impetus behind it. Like, well, what kinds of things should come before a court? Because again, if we come back to international criminal law, kind of, you know, the topic that I adore or love to hate, or how you want to say it. I mean, it is it springs out of the Second World War, and it springs out of a pretty imbalanced take on how to understand the atrocities of that war, how to understand like guilt and violence in that war, right? How to make only certain things problematic. And even though we eventually add a genocide convention, you see in the Nuremberg tribunals, you see a lot of things overlooked or misunderstood. And so this move to try and think, well, if there's a treaty, then there must be a need to control this. So there should probably be a court that thinks about this treaty. I think that's a really interesting approach to how we imagine what international law could and should cover. And again, comes back to this question about, well, what could the benefit of a supranational court be? What do we gain by this institution that doesn't have local knowledge, but which should, at least in principle, have some kind of objectivity over the topic? And so I think so the Pan-African Lawyers Union, watch those guys.
Those are some very cool suggestions of what to watch. Thank you very much for highlighting them for us. As a final question, I almost, given the sort of saga you talked us through at the beginning of putting this book together, I almost am like, ooh, I shouldn't make her go back into that headspace. But I am very curious always about what to look for in the future, as evidenced by my last question. So on a more direct level, what are you working on now or next, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this exact topic, anything you'd like to highlight in that realm?
Oh, thanks so much. You know, it feels like Christmas. You want me to talk about what I'm doing now? It's too kind. So I have been working on terror law. So I've been observing terror trials and looking at the question of, so Europeans who commit terror, so people who joined ISIS, et cetera. And I've been writing on that and the revocation. We were, especially in Denmark, we've started revoking citizenship. And then in concert with that, but it's all driven by this question of who belongs, right? Who makes the state? And then getting back to some of the same questions that are really are driving the Justice Laboratory book, then, okay, what is the state and how is the state constrained by law? What role can law play in that? And those interests have led me to my current book project, which is about Colombia. So in Colombia, you have some pretty fascinating statecraft questions going on following the 2016 peace accords. And so there's a peace agreement, and the peace agreement sets up a series of institutional promises. One of them is a restorative justice organ. You can call it a court. It's called the JEP, the Jurisdicción Especial de Paz. And that institution, which sits in Bogota but works regionally, is creating, it's looking at patterns of criminality. So they have like 100 sociologists that they employ on one of their floors who look to see what are the, when we look at violence in Colombia, can we find certain things that characterize that violence? And based on those patterns, they have constructed a series of cases. And then they're using this idea called macro criminality, which originates from this German jurist, to try and decide how liability should be assessed for those patterns of crime that they locate. And then if you cooperate with the court, then there's a restorative justice. And we're now, right now, waiting to hear what those sanctions will look like. And they're imagined to be, again, restorative sanctions. So in case number one, which is about the FARC and kidnapping, there the idea was if you cooperate with the tribunal and you, or with JEP, and you say what you know, in this case, it looks a lot like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, right? It borrows some of these ideas. Then you'll be eligible for this restorative sanction, which could be somehow trying to address a harm. So maybe you build a school or build a road, and how that will be carried out, how you can ensure the safety of the people who are going to be subject to these sanctions, that's getting resolved right now. And one, so there's just a zillion things that are fascinating about that in Colombia. But I think the big thing that I find so interesting is the willingness of Colombia to engage in kind of big greenfield, exciting new structural ideas. And so I say this as an American who now has lived in Europe for 30 years, very frustrated over, for example, our inability to address the migration, if you want to call it crisis, the number of people who die seeking to come to Europe. Like we just don't have any great ideas. People keep dying. And it seems like there could be many ways that we might address this. We don't. And then you look at a country like Colombia and it's really trying brand new things. And it might not work. So one of the things that my book looks at is at this point, it's a book project. So the thing that my book project is working on, mm-hmm. what I'm developing is this idea of non-repetition, which is a right that's recognized by the Inter-American Court. It's not a right we're very familiar with. It doesn't exist as a right in that sense in European human rights law. But what might this right, this I think is another way of understanding the responsibility that the state has toward its citizens. So in a sense, it's just another way of stating the social contract. But with the right, with a citizen's capacity to insist that a state not repeat its past errors, it's possible that some of the jurisprudence coming out of the special court in Colombia might not withstand constitutional scrutiny, right? So there's so many challenges, but there's still this, like, there's real creativity and real engagement. So it's not just that the institution is engaging, but there's real conversation. So when I go to Colombia now, I've been so fortunate as to go several times, and everybody, I've never talked to anyone who doesn't know what I'm studying this institution and what it means. And everyone knows about it, has an opinion about it. You can pick up books, you go to a bookstore. So you have this level of conversation, this real like political salience of law, legal institutions, and law is a possible way of trying to resolve political impasses. That's one way of putting the terrible violence, you know, 70 years of war in Colombia. So I think that is another, again, it all comes back to this question of how can law help solve the state? But I really think that we certainly where I am in Europe, we ignore South America and we ignore it at our peril. There's really amazing things happening. So I'm taking my focus to Colombia.
Well, I'm glad that it's a book project because that means it'll be a book and then we can have you back and you can tell us even more about it.
So wonderful. Yes.
Yes. We will look forward to that. But in the meantime, while you're off actually, you know, doing that work, listeners can read the book on Africa that we've been discussing until this point, titled The Justice Laboratory, International Law in Africa. Shearson, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you very, very much for having me.